explaining that he was our lawyer. This caused the officers to become more visibly nervous, including one who pulled a riot gun from his police car and proceeded to aim at Lennox from close range. All of us froze. We knew only too well that any innocent gesture could be construed as a reach for a weapon, and that this confrontation could easily become a recapitulation of the events that had left Asada with a murder charge. The spurious explanation given by police for this ambush was a warrant for my arrest, later proven false. Though they allowed us to leave, it was only shortly after we arrived at Lennox's that we discovered they had already called for reinforcements and literally surrounded the house. With one of the first Black woman judges in New Jersey and several other prominent community figures at the house, we were nonetheless compelled to call on higher powers in the form of Congressman John Conyers in Washington. We figured a request for a federal escort out of the state of New Jersey might put some pressure on the local police. These were the kinds of measures, and friends, needed in such a volatile time. I relate this incident in detail because it may help readers of Asada's autobiography not only to focus on the political role of the police during the 1970s, but also to better understand important historical aspects of the routine racial profiling associated with current police practices. Such a historical perspective is especially important today when brazen expressions of structural racism, such as the pattern of mass imprisonment to which communities of color are subjected, are rendered invisible by the prevailing moral panic over crime. And if this were not enough, we find that at the same time, such remedies as affirmative action programs and such safety nets as social welfare are being consistently disestablished. When Richard Nixon raised the slogan of law and order in the 1970s, it was used in part to discredit the Black liberation movement and to justify the deployment of the police, courts, and prisons against key figures and this and other radical movements of the era. Today, the ironic coupling of a declining crime rate and the consolidation of a prison industrial complex that makes increased rates of incarceration its economic necessity has facilitated the imprisonment of 2 million people in the United States. In this ideological context, political prisoners like Asada Shakur, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and Leonard Peltier are represented in popular political discourse as criminals who deserve either to be executed or to spend the rest of their lives behind bars. During the late 1990s, the racist hysteria directed against Asada was resuscitated when the New Jersey State Police reputedly prevailed upon Pope John Paul II to use the occasion of his first trip to Cuba as pressure for Fidel Castro to extradite Asada. As if this were not enough, New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman offered a $50,000 reward, later doubled, for Asada's return. And Congress passed a bill calling on the government of Cuba to initiate extradition procedures. In an open letter to the Pope, Asada asks a question that should concern all of us. Why, I wonder, do I warrant such attention? What do I represent that is such a threat? We would all do well to seriously ponder her questions. Why indeed was she constructed by the government and mass media as a consummate enemy in the 1970s, only to reemerge at the turn of the century as a singular target of governors, Congress, and the Fraternal Order of Police? What has she been made to represent? What ideological work has this representation performed? In the 1970s, Asada Shakur's image was deployed on official FBI wanted posters and in the popular media as visual evidence of the terrorist motivations of the Black liberation movement. Black militants were assumed to be enemies of the state and were associated with communist challenges to capitalist democracy. The pro